My name is Wanda Dyfeld and I'm from Brazil. I'm a Lutheran pastor. I work as a professor, a theologian, at the Lutheran Seminary in the city of São Leopoldo, which is in the southern part of Brazil. I have been, for many years, the vice president of our seminary. I'm currently dean of graduate studies. At the Lutheran Seminary, I hold the position, it's a chair of feminist theology. Feminist theology is one of the required courses at the seminary. It's taken by men, by women. I have been sharing this story a little bit over during dinner time, so I won't expand on that. And our subject for this evening is ecofeminism in Latin America. Ecofeminism in Latin America. And before we start with what I have prepared, I would like to have share your impressions, your ideas. When we talk about ecofeminism, what comes to your mind? What do you understand with that topic? And I think it's a very rich subject, especially in the North Atlantic setting. So I would like to hear from you what you have to say about this. What do you understand as being ecofeminism? Right, who wants to start?
I think there's some connections between nature is oppressed by patriarchy and those modes, and women is oppressed. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, women have been associated with nature, mm-hmm. And that way have been dominated by spirit, by the mind, mm-hmm. things like that.
Okay, so have you been doing some reading on that?
Yeah.
Because you just gave your stuff away. any other comment? Yes?
Oh, not
scratching your hair. any other idea that you would like to share?
I think about feminist notion of the ethic of care, mm-hmm. as opposed to the ethic of justice, and mm-hmm. how care is not only a dominant theme for human relations, but how can we see ourselves being held in the bonds of care of creation, the divine creation, and how we're also asked to care for it in a similar way.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, there you have a professor of ethics giving that definition. So these are all hard acts to follow now. Any other comment? I will be sharing with you some of the works of a very good friend of mine, whose name is Ivone Gebara. Ivone Gebara has written this book. It was translated from Portuguese into English, called Longing for Running Water. Hmm. Longing for Running Water. And Ivone Gebara, besides being a very good friend, she's also an excellent theologian. And she has been able to dedicate some of her time in doing more research in the issue of ecofeminism. And this is a book that will come to the bookstore in the next day, so hang in there. It will still arrive, hopefully before you leave. Otherwise, it's by Fortress Press, and that's always easily accessible. Ivone Gebara has, as a Roman Catholic nun in Brazil, she has always had a very strong commitment, as most of the feminist theologians and liberation theologians in our continent, with the cause of the poor, the cause of the oppressed, the cause of those who are socially excluded. And she got into trouble with the Roman Catholic Church because she publicly defended that women could have ownership of our own bodies and making decisions on reproductive rights. And that was not well accepted by the Vatican, and so she was silenced also, similarly to Leonardo Boff, another liberation theologian. And Yvonne Gibara was then sent to Belgium. And while she was there, she took the opportunity and she did another doctorate in theology, which we always say, well, she used the fact that she couldn't be talking publicly, so she went and did some more research. And part of that is the result of this book that she that I will be doing some readings. And the way that ecofeminism is described also in the North Atlantic setting is the way it is described also in Latin America. I mean, the basis for it is very similar. What feminism is a combination of social feminism and holistic ecology, meaning to say it draws from these two streams to create something new, which is called then ecofeminism. Social feminism is very much concerned with the rights of women, with the accessibility of women to the same opportunities that are open to any other human beings, of assuring women's safety in society, in discussing women's long-standing history of discrimination and revising that. But added now to a new trend called holistic ecology. And this is something that comes not exclusively from theology itself, even though I think in religion, in not only in Christianity, but in religion per se, we can find a very strong ecological dimension. In Christianity, and here we draw also from Judaism, we perceive that from the first chapter of Genesis, that God creates the world, that creates the habitat, that separates day and night and earth and water, and creates all the animals and creates human beings. And that creation, at the end of every day, God says, this is good. And when God creates human beings, God says, this is very good. And that creation is part of the element also into which we are born. Of course, we need to make a whole discussion also of the misuse that the Genesis passage, especially when God gives to man and woman the capacity to rule over, not only, not as stewards, as it has been recently interpreted, but meaning to say as gardeners of this, and that was many times used as to exploit, to raven the earth, the soil, the habitat as we know it. But the discovery that we are a part of a larger life than our own simple existence is already present in this Genesis passage, because in each day God creates something that is special, that is unique. And we human beings, through a very human-centered and anthropocentric perspective, we always thought that we were like the culmination of creation itself. Like God created everything, and then, like the cherry on the cake, you know, we human beings were created. But of course, what God created last was the day of rest. That's the Sabbath. That is what God created as the culmination of creation, and that's something that we can imitate. We can imitate God in resting. When we are resting, we're imitating. This is a divine capacity when we rest. But God created humanity in the sixth day, and we are so little important in this creation that human beings, Genesis 1, 26, 27 tells exactly that God created Adam, God created humanity and created as men and women, as man and woman, both in the image of God. But this man and woman are not even deserving a whole day for the creation. But men and women are created in the same day as reptiles and domestic animals. So we are so little in creation that we were created in the same day as cows and crocodiles, if that puts it into perspective for us. And I think that's very important, because really it's a humbling exercise, come to think about it. But that unfortunately is not the tradition. We have done a lot of work in redefining the power of humanity in reshaping our relationship to ourselves, to the world as we know it, to nature, and to God. And the way that we have come about, I think, is this holistic ecology that social feminism then combines itself with to form ecofeminism. Of course, whenever we talk about any subject like that, the way that we look at the world, the way we look at people, the way we look at events, and also how we look at the environment, is very much shaped by our religious convictions. And of course, it has to reflect on how do we perceive God acting in our midst. If we see nature as part of God's good creation, and our responsibility as being like the gardeners, the stewards, to take care of this, we have one approach to creation. And this is very noticeable here at Holden Village, in the way we take care of garbage, in the way we take care not to feed wild animals, in the way we are careful not to put fires in the forests, and how we really try to manage, to administrate this ecosystem, because that is a reflection of how our own spirituality also works, the way how we perceived how God created all of this, and how we are part of this intrinsic life system. But as I said, this awareness is something quite recent, even though we presuppose that is the way humanity has always thought. That is not true. Unfortunately, we have come to situations of dreadful situations of mismanagement, of expropriation, of uneven distribution of land, decimation of species, because also our religious beliefs have led us into misinterpreting certain things. And I think that has to do also to a way in which, especially through the Industrial Revolution, through the Enlightenment, how we perceive ourselves as being the center of humanity. But not only that, not only humanity as such, but how the mental, the intellectual, would be much more important than anything that relates to human bodies. And especially in feminist theology, a lot of work has been done precisely in critiquing a very dualistic, when I mean dualistic, a very a mode of perceiving ourselves in culture, in society, in religion, that divides us in parts, in pieces. And saying, for one side, this dichotomy between a public sphere and a private sphere, a dichotomy between the body and the soul, a separation between culture and nature, a dichotomy between a passion and reason, or heart and mind. And we have noticed that whatever has to do with the soul, with the mind, with culture, with the public sphere, that has been considered in a higher status than anything related to nature, to human bodies, to passion, anything related to the everyday life. And we notice that the seed of that is present not only in religion, but in philosophy itself, especially in the, and at least that's the critique that is made out front, is to the Greek philosophy that sets this this framework of thought and that Christianity bought into. Now, here I need to say that I think there's a difference between, even though Christianity sprung off from Judaism, that the Semitic worldview does have much more of a holistic approach than the Christian approach. And why I say that? If you go and read the church fathers, especially in the second to the fourth century, you will see how fascinated they really were with this Greek philosophy and how much they wanted to show how Christianity was something that could be sold to the Roman and to the Greek world, because it would fit into that framework of mind. And in doing so, you would be shocked in reading what some of the church fathers would say, for instance, about women, what they would say about human bodies. They would say that everything that relates to nature, to reproduction, to everyday necessities, that is considered inferior to that other realm which elevates, which is the spiritual world, that which points to the divine, to the holy, and the separation between body and the soul. And Christianity very quickly became obsessed with saving the soul and denying the human body. And there was even a discussion in Origen, one of the church fathers, who would say, well, take the example of women. Women can be good Christians, but they are only good Christians if they act as men would do. And women are saved not because they are women, but because they have souls, and souls don't have a soul doesn't have a sex. And it's genderless, so of course women would be saved because of this detail. And he would say a good woman who was a good Christian would be considered in the light of God as an honorary man. Can you believe that? It's true, it's Origen.
Yeah. Which origin? Now, where did that come from?
Origen, yeah. In one of his writings, he says that. What I find interesting is how already in the first centuries Christianity forgot that Semitic, that Jewish root that affirmed the goodness of human bodies, because after all that's in Genesis, and very quickly moved into this dichotomic, dualist worldview in which the mind, the soul, reason, culture was elevated, and everything that had to do with body, to creation, nature, reproduction, taking care of children, feeding children, taking care of animals, that was considered a waste of time, because anything that dealt with the everyday life was considered as taking away attention, energy, taking away time that should be precious and should be spent rather to elevating one's soul through prayer, meditation, readings of the scriptures and things like that. And that created, I think, a very strong case. And I think this distinction has led us into a lot of trouble, because religion started being much more concerned with saving souls than saving bodies. And I say that not ironically, that in 200 years of Christianity, the fact that we have not cared to save human bodies has led us into a situation in the misuse of religion as justifying unjust systems, justifying expropriation of land, justifying slavery, justifying the massacre of the native populations, because it was always believed, well, we have to save people's souls, and that is what we want to do. It's not saving bodies. We do not care for the well-being of the body. To the contrary, the more the body is tortured, the more the body is confined, restricted, the more the soul will be elevated. And you know that that is also part of some of the experiences in the Middle Ages, in which people would actually punish themselves, you know, the flagellations, because by mortifying the flesh, they would elevate their spirit. And I think that's a tradition that we have carried well into the 18th and 19th century. So much so that in Latin America, this disregard for the well-being of the body has led us into a very conflicted situation of uneven distribution of resources. In most of the countries nowadays, our population is, I would say, 99% Christian. It's one of the continents in which you will have the majority of the people identifying with Christianity, and yet, by being Christian, this does not make one difference whatsoever. And I just talked at a mission conference last year in Colombia, in Barranquilla, where the Latin American Council of Churches met. And it was a consultation on mission, and I said, we need to revise what we understand as mission. We are all Christians, and how come that Christian values, Christian attitude does not reflect in the way we deal with politics, with the way we deal with economics, with the way we deal with our national natural resources, with the lack of care that we have for water systems, or with the distribution of land? How come that we can make such a separation between with what we believe and what we put into practice? And this contradiction can only be explained by this dichotomy between body and soul, because Christianity wanted to save souls and not care about the well-being of bodies. Well, in that sense then, ecofeminism in Latin America proposes a bodily perception of the unity and interdependence of all living things, and the growing awareness that we are all one body with the whole universe. Meaning to say, what happens to me is not is intimately connected with what happens to any of you. There it's no longer possible to defend this whole system of ideas in which the richness of one company in Brazil and apparently the well-being of the owners of that one company has nothing to do with the fact that thousands of people are jobless, or the fact that that factory will pollute the whole water system, or that sharing beforehand that government after government gets elected based on paying off people to maintain them in power, to assure mm-hmm. their own access to the goods and the revenues that are created in one country.
Saint Bonnet?
Yes.
I don't know if you want to go down this direction, but does this end up being amongst other things, a critique of capitalism in and of itself?
Yeah. In doing this analysis that feminist ecofeminism does, It wants to do a critique of a whole patriarchal system, which some authors like Elizabeth Chisla Fiorenza have critiqued as patriarchal, or which some economists like Hinglamert in Costa Rica have called bluntly as being a militaristic, racist, and classist, and which terminology that you are tired of hearing about globalization. It is a critique of that. And it is, if we are at the stage that we are nowadays, religion, and especially Christianity, cannot simply do like Pontius Pilate and say, well, we wash our hands, we have nothing to do with it. And at least not in Latin America. I don't know if it can do this in your country. Maybe we should discuss about that. But in Latin America, if you have a system of religion that for 500 years helped to colonize, in which Christianity arrived to the continent with the cross in one hand and the sword on the other hand,
yeah,
in which it came to defend the property, the access of goods of the Portuguese or the Spanish, then that type of Christianity needs to revise itself and do public repentance. But so much harm has been done that it's not only a matter of liturgical repentance, it's a critique and a strong commitment to engender new types of social relations as well. And I think it has to do, it needs to be done, at least the way we are doing it in ecofeminism in Latin America. We are doing it in two different levels. One is the level of how does this movement have an impact in developing policies. You know that the big consultation that happened in 1992 called the on the issue of ecology, it happened in Rio de Janeiro. And it was quite appropriate that it happened in Rio de Janeiro to show the population that it was important to have a government commitment to not only seize the pollution of the large industries, to talk about issues of global warming and things like that. But for us, it means, when we talk about ecofeminism, it means coming down to even more basic stuff than these global issues. It means talking about people's access to drinking water. You would be surprised, but in Brazil, more than half of the population does not have access to drinking water. It's like it's you go and you drink water; it's semi-safe. You wonder if it is okay. In most of the cities, the large cities, it's estimated that 70% of the sewage system is not treated. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? In large cities like São Paulo, like 30% of the sewage system is actually treated. So we're talking about water, we are talking about the sewage system, we are talking about access to education, we are talking about health. You would be surprised in knowing that I know that in your country it is quite common that people now have to have health plans. You know, it's like private companies that sell out health plans. In Brazil, there is this is now quite fashionable as well, because after all we live in a globalized world. But the majority of the people will not have access to that. 90% of the population does not have access to a health plan. So they have to use the public health system. In order to do that, if somebody gets sick, you have to stand in line in one of the clinics. And you go up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you stay in line until 8 o'clock when it opens, and many times you hear the doctor isn't coming today. it means dealing with the well-being of human bodies in such an elementary, such an essential way. And so we're talking the one level, yes, there is the big discussion about policies, but on the other level, we are talking about basic human rights as well. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about the well-being of human bodies. Mm-hmm. And if our religion has not defended that, the integrity of human bodies, how much less will we defend the integrity of the whole of creation? No, if we, in our mentality, if we have defended that humanity is the center, wrongly so, because we have acknowledged that humanity is no longer the center of everything. But in such an anthropocentric reasoning, not even other human beings' bodies has been taken care for, much less the care for the whole of creation. And I think that type of approach has led many of the grassroots groups, and here I want to share a little bit of some of the initiatives that we have done, not even using the terminology ecofeminism, and how we are working especially with women in assuring the well-being of their bodies. And many of these initiatives are taken by the churches, and one of them I would like to highlight also by the Lutheran Church in Brazil. And it is developed by an organization, and it's an NGO that works with the help of the Lutheran Church. And it deals with identifying herbs and teas that are good for our health, so in trying to do a more preventative work in medicine. I know that you're going to go out with our expert in plants in the next days, and you will find out about the beautiful plants here in Holden Village. We have had a lot of studies done, especially in identifying what's the capacity of cure or prevention that herbs have or plants have in Brazil. And we have learned a lot, especially from the indigenous population, because they do have a lot of knowledge about teas. And so what is good, what type of remedy is good for high blood pressure, for low blood pressure, for diabetes, for cholesterol, and things like that, that we have now learned to dialogue with other cultures in order to identify some of these remedies. And this same NGO also works very closely with creating different food habits. I mean to say, if you in the United States are very much concerned with all the junk food that people are eating, leading many people to disease because they do not eat appropriate and healthy food, well, that too is globalized. We say, well, it's a McDonald's world nowadays because our kids want to go out, and because McDonald's is very much like this middle class thing in Brazil, because everybody wants to eat McDonald's. It's like this big program that families do on Saturday nights, you know, they want to go out and do something special, and then they go and eat McDonald's, you know, just like the Americans do. And they find it so cool. Well, it's a global culture. And in helping people to develop healthy habits and doing that in church groups. Church groups have really taken it upon themselves, and the churches worked very closely also with people, experts in nutrition, to identify, to have people relearn healthy ways of eating. And it's I find it fascinating because I think I should write an article about this, that Brazilians are eating garbage, because what many people would put in the garbage, you know, in the compost, is being used as source of fiber and helping to enrich people's diet. For instance, the banana peel, the peel of banana, you know, it's cut into little pieces and then it's made with a little bit of sugar and it's dried and people eat that as a snack. It's really quite delicious. Same thing about the orange peel, about the green leaves of manioc. And manioc is like a cassava that we only eat the root, we don't eat the green part. So that is now being dried and grounded and it has so much, such a strong source of vitamin. And then all the things that would normally go away and go to the garbage, and that's now being used like eggshell, you know, most of us throw away, you know. And the nutritionist said, well, throw away the egg, but keep the shell because, you know, that's very good. It's a source of calcium. And helping people in learning, you know, not to throw away, because different from your context in which access to food seems so easy, for most people in a poor country, if you have an egg, you will probably boil that egg and share it among two or three. You know, it's very different from your world setting. And so, of course, you want to make the most out of it. Now, Ivone Jabara has a very interesting passage here that I would like to read, in which she shows that, in fact, it's not, when we talk about the problems of pollution, we talk about many of the threats of global warming, if we talk about also issues of nuclear waste, she says, the whole issue has, it affects always the poor in the first place, even though the poor are not the ones who have caused it. It's always the poor who are the first ones to suffer with it. Mm-hmm. Because our kids are the ones who play in the middle of the streets where the sewage runs, because they will not have the nice streets, you know, where the pavement is. And they will be the first ones to get sick. One of the largest incidents of radiation happened in Brazil a couple of years ago. Not an issue of one of the, like a Chernobyl, but one X-ray machine was simply thrown in the dump, you know. And the kids went there, played, and there was this shiny thing, and they passed it on themselves. They ate some of that, and of course it was radiation. And many of them died, and they're still having consequences nowadays. So the poor are the first ones to suffer with this. And the ones who have least access to solving the problem immediately. And here's a quote. Women and men struggle to survive, and they struggle a great deal. But they don't always make the connection between the chickens they sell on the corner, the dirty water that runs in the streets after street cleaning, and their children's health. The street often turns into a public garbage dump. On the inside, their houses are generally neat, but the street, the collective space, is practically a no man's land. Because the poor have almost no access to public services, they do not care for public spaces as if it were their own, as if it were something a poor person could consider mine. They know just how little the public spaces are really theirs, and by defiling or neglecting them, they reproduce on a small scale the neglect they themselves suffer. I always find it fascinating that, and I had to share this the other day with Lauren, it's like Brazilians, we are very much concerned with keeping our houses very, very clean inside. Mm-hmm. In working in the jungle in the Amazon area, I was always surprised that the women would keep their pots and pans shining so much. I mean, you could actually see your face reflecting on the pots and pans. And they would put it in the living room so that everybody could see that beautiful and shiny thing. So the houses inside are impeccable. That's Brazilian cultural thing. But from the door outside, we don't care. That's the street. I mean, that's public. That belongs to nobody. And I noticed it's so different in the United States because everything is so clean and tidy outside. And you know, houses and cars are, you know, somewhat messy sometimes. Because, I mean, it's the public that people are responsible for. And it's a cultural difference. And the poor, they feel like it's okay to also dump things on the street because that's our culture. That belongs to nobody. And there is no sense of ownership about public things because that's not theirs. This is 500 years of colonialism right there and then, because anything, any public park, anything that is put like an artwork, it will be defiled. There is no sense that this belongs to us. This belongs to somebody else. And the sense of ownership that you would feel for the public things. It's a cultural difference. And I think that has to do also with the public and the private sphere when it comes to women. Because most women will not talk about their concerns in public spheres. Because that's why church groups, and when we talk about women's capacity, self-esteem issues, when we talk about the fact that women can make a difference, and that we are not just bound to this subservient role that our machista culture has told us, how difficult it is for us women to overcome that. And here is another quote by Ivone Gebara, and then I want to open it for discussion. She says, "There is a tendency to appreciate the role of women to the degree that it resembles that of the feminine in nature. In other words, are women more capable of critical ecological thought in virtue of their domestic experience, especially that of maternity? Here, once again, we confront an emphasis on the singularity of women's experience. And this ends up leading us into essentialist discourse. More attentive reflection should lead us to realize that while women do play social roles, they have a human subjectivity that always exceeds and overflows the confines of their gender identity. The involvement of women and of feminists in the ecological struggle is due less to their feminine roles in family life, although we admit that ecofeminism raises some echoes in this sphere, than to access to the public realm where they gain political experience, a wider and more diversified vision of human problems, and the confidence to criticize the existing culture and propose changes." And of course, you know that is a fact that happens all over the world, that women are, of course, more affected than men by inadequate environmental and development policies. Women are always the poor among the poor. And that's why we started working with the church, we started working with women, because first, women are our church audience. I mean, these are the members of our congregations. And we started working with women, hoping to make a change in a wider scale. But also because women were the ones more affected by the environmental problems that we are facing right now in Brazil. I have some more things to say, but I think it would be important to open up for some questions and comments on your side. Otherwise, you'll fall asleep in your chairs. It has been a long day.
Can I ask about the work in the Amazon? Oh, something else. In the Amazon, where you did your internship and other things that the church in Brazil is involved with, does that affect women?
Yeah. I did my part of my work. I have worked all over Brazil. So even though I'm living right now in the southern part of Brazil, one significant part was done in the Amazon area proper. And then I've also worked in a city called Belém do Pará, which is in the very north of Brazil, almost close to Venezuela. And I was working with in one of the shanty towns, the favelas, and the houses were there was no in the city of Belém, as in any other large city in Latin America, you know that the downtown area is the place where the affluent people live. And then with the migration, with the fact that many, many people were coming from the countryside to the city increased. But in the city of Belém, which is right at the fringe of the Amazon River, there was no place for people to go. And people ended up building their houses in the swamp areas, in the marshes. And they built their houses on poles. So if they are high from the ground, so when the tide comes up, the houses were not washed away. So if you can imagine that, you know, houses built on poles. And then to have access to the houses, small and narrow bridges are built to connect one house to the next. So there's a labyrinth of bridges and you know, wooden planks that are just placed there for people to have access to their houses. So there's this whole city practically, because there are hundreds and thousands of people living in shanty towns like this. And I was very impressed because I was working in this neighborhood and I was working with the issue of literacy campaign, because I was working with Paulo Freire's method of education, and we were having a group of people that was meeting there. And people did not know at first that I was a theological student. They thought I was an educator, and as such I was there only to teach them to read and write. And then I proposed, and I noticed that these were very religious people, because Brazilians are very religious people. Our problem is not lack of religion. We love it so much that we even follow more than one at once, you know? We can be Roman Catholic, we can be Buddhist at the same time. I mean, there's no contradiction whatsoever. You know, we are quite drawn to religion. And I often offered that if we could do some Bible studies, because we could use the biblical text to work also the literacy issue. And it was very interesting working with especially the group of women, because their number one concern was, since they were living in this situation, I mean, can you imagine, there's no sewage system, okay? So whatever you do, your bodily necessities, everything is just thrown out of the window or in a hole in your house. So at the bottom, you know, of the swamp is like open sewage. The smell is horrible. I was lucky enough never to fall into it, because some people, you know, the wood gets rotten and, you know, things decompose, and, you know, there you step into something and you fall down, and then people need to fetch you out. And it was fascinating for me to see how, on the one hand, people get accustomed to living in inhuman situation. After a while, you get accustomed to the smell. First, I felt nauseated. You know, can you imagine open sewage? If you have done garbology, you know, you and now imagine that multiplied by 1,000, you know, because everything in the jungle, in the Amazon area, this is hot, this is tropical, and it rains every day. So it's really the foul smell of it. And people are accustomed. The first time I thought I was going to vomit. And then, but the second time, you know, okay, my nose wasn't, you know, as sensitive anymore. And by the third time I was there, and one gets accustomed. And I think there's something good and bad in human nature when we so easily get accustomed also to the misery and to living in this inhuman situation. And in working in this neighborhood through the Bible study and through the literacy campaign, we realized that one of the basic issues was access to drinking water, because the pipes of the water were running through the open sewage. And there was only one public faucet that everybody had to come and fetch water from that one public faucet and then put it up in big buckets of water, and then the women and the girls had to carry it back home. So that was the water for the day. And there were huge lines waiting. And we decided, well, this is something that community thought that was important for them to do. So we mobilized, we went down to City Hall, and we requested that the faucets would be closer to their homes, so the women wouldn't have to carry water so much, and would be elevated so that they would not be in the middle of the sewage. So, I mean, that was a very small initiative, but it did have that seed of consciousness that people had, led people to think about their situation, say, well, things can be better. We don't have to be, to resign ourselves to living in this. Yes.
Two parts. How do you think the Church of Brazil is complicit? And how do you think the Church of America, United States, is complicit in the systems of injustice being maintained?
The Church in Brazil, through colonialism, I explained that a little bit already, is complicit with this situation, because it too maintained that dichotomy between body and soul, but it did horrific damage in justifying theologically why should the native people be captured and put to work, because by punishing their bodies they would be baptized into Christianity and their souls would be saved. And the same thing about the slaves. They were baptized already in their ships coming over to Brazil. And they said, well, it's baptism by fire. And the slave masters were seen as doing a good deed by the fact that they would maintain the slaves and force them to work, because by punishing the body, by tormenting the body, they would come to believe in Jesus. I mean, this is horrific. This is part of our history, and I think the Church has much to repent about that. The churches in the United States. Now, you see, up till the 19th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, Roman Catholicism was the only religion in the whole of Latin America, so to say. And in the beginning of the 20th century, we started to receive many missionaries. And I have to say that we have received and many missions that came from the United States. And some of that mission has had a great deal of positive impact, but I have to say that many of the problems that we have nowadays are due to the neo-Pentecostal churches that originated in this part of the world. Even though you will say, well, they had their origin in Europe, but the mission came strongly from this side of the world. And I think that has to do also with the preaching that continues to elevate the soul and say, no, we have to save people, so you have to convert to Christianity, but never really challenged any of the unjust system in which we are living in. And I think that caused so much harm that nowadays when we have churches. We have now our own brand of Brazilian neo or late Pentecostal churches. There is one church called Universal Church of the Kingdom of God with its bishop, main bishop called Edir Macedo, who actually no longer lives in Brazil. He lives in Miami now, because everybody who is important goes to live in Miami. That's not how Brazilians think. And he's a strong developer of this prosperity theology. And you would be surprised to see how many poor people actually follow this religion, because they say the more you give to the church, the more God will give back to you. Mm-hmm. And if you have not received enough from God, it's because you have not given enough to the church yet. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, the Brazilian version of our IRS is behind this bishop, because he has fled the country because he has gotten so rich, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know how come people were giving to God and he just appropriated it, but it's like, yeah, it's to the personal benefit. So I could tell you really horror stories about religion in Brazil, but people are very faithful. People really trust and believe. And I think the big question, the big challenge that we have is, how do we put our spirituality, how do we put our faith, and how do we put this strong commitment and belief that we have? And there are so many theologians and churches that do think differently, and yet we do not seem to be powerful or capable to make that dramatic change that is necessary. So we are like little ants. Working, and we do small things, but I think if we are in a large enough number that we can make a difference. Yeah. Any other comment, question?
I had one thought that just kept coming to me, and that was the concept that he said, if we have not done a good job with the body,
yeah,
have we done a good job with the soul?
Yeah. What do you want to say about that?
No, I'm just questioning that. I'm saying if we haven't, maybe we haven't done a good job with the soul either.
Yeah. Okay. I think you're right. And we inherited that, and we just played into a game that was already, you know, questionable to begin with.
Wendy?
Yes?
In Brazil, is there any, I really don't know enough to know what the indigenous religions would be, and whether or not there is any movement to reject Christianity and to restore the first religious basis, presuming that it would be more harmony with the earth.
Yeah. The religious practice of the native people depend very much on the community that they belong to, because each group has its different practices and rituals. The Guarani are completely distinct from the Kulina, which are completely distinct from the Surui, and so on. Now, nowadays, you would be surprised that most of these indigenous communities have missionaries working with them, because they have been such a target to mission. And many of them, I would say, of questionable reputation, you know, because people want to convert souls. And the Lutheran Church has always been very careful in sending missionaries to the indigenous people, because our approach has not been to convert them to Christianity. And I think one of the most powerful examples of the reputation that the Lutheran Church has had through an ecumenical agency of work with indigenous population was, for instance, an invitation that came from one of the northernmost communities called the Kulinas. And they invited Lutheran pastors to come and live with them. They said, we want you to be here. We are interested in knowing about you, which I thought was fascinating, because not us sending missionaries out, but they invited missionaries to come. And they said, we need white people here to help to defend us against other people, other white people that come in. So if you are here, if you are here and you are Christians, you can say, no, thank you, these people already have a religion. Which I thought was quite fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so they caught on, you know, that the use of power also in our white society. As I said beforehand, the whole knowledge about plants and things of the kind, there is some that is popular knowledge already, but there is some knowledge that is restricted to the religious leader, and only the religious leader can have knowledge of that, because that is sacred knowledge. And in the indigenous community will not give away that knowledge, because that is sacred to its own. So it cannot be commercialized. It can be given, but it cannot be commercialized. So
I think our time has ended. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.